Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome back to week two. We are grateful to have you here tonight. How many of you guys here for the first time? You didn't make last week. Well, welcome. We are so happy to have you guys here. How many of you are not here this week who were here last week? Okay. All right. Just wanted to make sure. Hey, happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone. I wanted to just start us off a little bit early tonight with some real intelligent things like some St. Patrick's Day Irish jokes. How about that? So we can celebrate St. Patrick's Day. Okay, you ready? Why do leprechauns make good secretaries? They're great at shorthand. What do you get when you cross... Oh, thank you, Michael. What do you get when you cross Quasimodo with an Irish football player? The halfback of Notre Dame. How did the Irish jig get started? Too much to drink, not enough restrooms. What's Irish and stays out all night? Patio furniture. How many are here for the last time tonight? Okay, that's just... Why should you... I got this one for my wife today. Thank you, sweetheart. Why should you never iron a four-leaf clover? Because you don't want to press your luck. And what do you call an Irishman who bounces off walls? Rick O'Shea. Okay. All right. That's why we started a little early tonight. So the recording won't get that. The live stream people will stay connected with us. Well, we do. We are glad you're here tonight. Tonight, our topic is Who is Jesus? Now, a quick review for those of us who weren't here last week. We talked a lot about the fact that every one of us has faith. We exercise faith all the time in everything that we do. We don't necessarily think about it as faith, but it really is faith. There's really not a whole lot that we know with certainty. We don't live life necessarily in blind faith at all. I think we do a lot of examining to determine things that we talked about last week, like where do we go to school? What's the neighborhood we want to live in? Investments, stuff like that. We look for evidence to support those things. But basically... Every one of us basically has this model of logic. We don't think about it, but we do have it. And I want to just introduce us to this tonight just so you can see this. So every one of us has a worldview. Every one of us. It doesn't matter whether you're the CEO of Apple or you're a school teacher or an engineer or anything like that. It doesn't matter. Everyone has a worldview. It's a philosophy of life. And what is that? It's a grid whereby we try to make sense of life. It's a framework whereby we try to fit the things in life into a meaningful whole so that life makes sense, right? And every worldview is based on certain presuppositions. We suppose certain things to be true. And we hold those presuppositions by faith. We believe them by faith. We don't necessarily have all the evidence that we need, but we believe it by faith. And every faith position is supported by an authority. Who says so? Should I believe that authority? What's the basis upon which this authority should be believed? Well, that's basically determined by, and every authority is validated by evidence. So every one of us has a worldview based on things that we believe and things we don't believe. Those are held by faith, they're supported by an authority, and they are validated by evidence. That's how we live life. You get married, okay, you believe that that's the person you should marry. Do you know for a fact, better, worse, sickness, health, richer, poor, till death do you part? Do you know that? No, that's faith. What's it based on? The person that you're getting married to. Well, what's the evidence? Well, there's not a whole lot. There's enough, maybe, hopefully. But see, everything we do, you get on an airplane in faith. You're not going to fly with an airline that advertises, fly safely with us. We get there 72% of the time. You're not going to get on that airplane. A 72 may be a passing grade in college, but I'm not getting on that plane. You know, I mean, I'm just not going to do it. But you know, when we were younger, we really didn't look for much evidence, did we? Right? As kids, you just hear it and you believe it. Like, remember this, step on a crack. Right. It never worked. I can't tell you the number of times I was so angry with my mother. And I just run out. I got you now. Nothing ever happened. But remember this? If you urinate in a pool, there's a special dye that turns it bright red so that everyone will know. Right? Now, how many of you never peed in a pool? Just go ahead. You are a liar. Who is that? You've never been in a pool. This is great. All right. How about this one? If you swallow watermelon seeds, an entire watermelon will grow inside of you. Do you remember believing that one? And then, you know, mom takes you to the grocery, and then you see this. It's like, So, anyway, and then, of course, shame on you people. How do you tell them? How do you tell them he doesn't exist? What you do is this. Now you can do this. He was shot down by a drone. Okay? And I mean, just out of the sky. And just, kids, I'm sorry. We're going to do our best to make up for that. But, oh, the funeral. Oh, the funeral was horrible. So anyway, as we're kids, we just kind of believe everything. But today, our decisions have more gravity to them. If you're facing surgery, you know, you want to make sure you're going to the right doctor. All of these things are based on faith. We don't know that we're going to make it back home tonight, do we? You know, on the planet, there's 150,000 people wake up but don't make it back to their beds. In the United States, 7,700 people. We don't know that. Now, I'm not trying to scare you, but what I do want to hope that we will do is think. Because last week, I remember I asked you the question. I had David and Will come up here, and I think, who held? No, we weren't David and Will. It was David and Garrett. That's right. He didn't come back this week. I embarrassed him so bad. No, he's out of time. But remember, I said that every one of us, you know, there's the beginning of physical life, and there's the end of physical life, and every one of us is somewhere. We don't know where. I mean, this could be it. Tonight could be it. We don't know. But every one of us live by faith. And the question that I ask is what's your faith position? And it's interesting that, you know, you can sincerely believe something about what's on the other side of your last heartbeat, if there is anything, but sincerity doesn't mean a thing. Truth is self-validating. Truth doesn't need you to believe it to be true. Untruth doesn't need you to not believe it to not be true. Truth is truth. And so as we talked about Alpha, and I'm so grateful and so glad that you're at Alpha, and I'll tell you again what Alpha, for those of you here for the first time, what Alpha is not. Alpha is not a membership drive of this church. Alpha is not trying to get you to change your church or denomination. Basically, what we want to do is just come together, find out what is in the Bible, and whether you leave here believing it or not, at least you'll know what it says and what it doesn't say. I grew up believing a lot of things about the Bible that I found out after I opened it up. It doesn't say this. I had a dear friend who was a mentor of mine. I was his employee before I bought his company, but he went off to Harvard Executive Business School, and he came back with a little plaque, which I thought was so interesting, and it says, "Education is the process of moving from cocksure ignorance to thoughtful uncertainty." See, when it came, education is the process of moving from cocksure ignorance, I am absolutely certain about that which I know nothing about, to thoughtful uncertainty. I was cocksure ignorant when it came to Jesus. I thought, I'd heard his name so many times, I must have known who he was. But I believed in a Jesus that really did not exist. But he was basically, for me, he was, you know, inspired by a true story. You know, there were some elements of truth, but the truths that were found in this book that I, again, not asking you to believe,
were totally contrary. I was sincere in what I believed, but I was sincerely wrong. And so as we look tonight about who is Jesus, that may seem like a dumb question, but I don't think it's a dumb question at all. Because I was shocked to find out that the Jesus I believed in was not the Jesus that was to be found in this book. And so when I was introduced to the Jesus of the Bible and the Jesus of history, not the Jesus I said I had created in my own head that was convenient for me through just religious stereotyping. And when I became a follower of Christ some almost 50 years ago, he changed my life completely. But it was after that, after I had this moment of saying, if you're real, and if you love me, and if what this book says is true, I want to know that. And I'll go a little bit more into that next week. But it was then that I started to question and began looking for some evidence to learn if it was reasonable, if it made sense to consider faith in the person and the claims of Jesus Christ. It's like, what's the evidence? This is how my life changed. My worldview went from being me-centered. I'll introduce a word to you next week called me-ology. We'll go into that next week. But my worldview changed to where I became a follower of Christ. I believed that he was God. I believed that based on the Bible and other extenuating evidences. And that was based on the things that I saw. Should I? Am I having to throw my brain away to believe this? Is it just some nice feeling that you get? Or is there any ground to stand on that you could say, wait a minute. You know, there's a verse in the Hebrew scriptures at the beginning of the Bible, and it's the great Jewish prayer that says, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. It's like God didn't call us to check our brains at the door if we were going to know who Jesus is. Just get some nice feeling. Just believe it because your grandmother believed it, and she was a nice lady, so you want to believe what she believed. God doesn't ask us to check our brain at the door. But if we will use it, realizing if he is God, he is God, and we are humans, in humble search, if what this book says is true, he will show us who Jesus is and who he's not. Now, again, not asking you to believe that. I'm just asking you with me to not be like I was, cocksure ignorant, and at least to move to thoughtful uncertainty and to consider some things that maybe you haven't had the time to think about before, haven't wanted to think about before, afraid of the ramifications of it, so you certainly don't want to think about it until maybe you have to. And so that's what I'm so excited about, is you and I can just come here and we can just think together, reason together, consider things, talk about things, debate things. All right. So on page 12 of our manual, we can see that he existed. Now, there's no critically thinking, unbiased historian that would say that Jesus was a fable, that he did not exist. There's not a historian that's going to say that, whether it's historians. You'll see all types of historians. There are Roman historians like Josephus and Suetonius and Pliny, the disciples of Jesus. We're not talking about those, the apostles. We're talking about those who were followers of his, who wrote about him. And there are so many that wrote about Jesus, too, that were not followers. Like when I mentioned to you these historians that you never heard of, like Suetonius, maybe Pliny, you've heard of him. These were not people that were followers of Jesus. As a matter of fact, they were antagonists. Even the Jewish Talmud. Now, the Jewish Talmud is basically the embodiment of all things Jewish. And the only literature for the Jew that is greater than what this compendium of literature called the Talmud is the Hebrew Scriptures. The Hebrew Scriptures now would say these things about Jesus, that he was a heretic, that he was a failed student, that he was a sorcerer, and that he was executed at Passover. They call him in the Talmud, they call him Yeshu, which we get Jesus from. They also call him this, Ben Stada. That means son of infidelity. So there's no question that so many are taught that Jesus is the bastard son of a Roman soldier who raped Mary. Okay, that's historic. Now, I don't say that to denigrate the Jewish faith at all. Many Jews are wonderful people, and many Jews have come to be followers of Jesus Christ as well. And so, but the point is, in Jewish writing, historical writing, there is this Yeshu who lived. The great Roman historian Cornelius Tacitus, to whom I have a great family resemblance, as you can see, he wrote the history of Rome, the annals of Rome. And in the annals of Rome, this is a clip from what he wrote. He said, consequently, to get rid of the report that Nero had Rome burned, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of historical figure Tiberius at that time at the hands of one of the procurators, Pontius Pilate, historical figure at that time. And so we see here, just again, just a little introduction here, that history shows that this man walked the planet in what we call the first century AD. But here's the really question, what about the Bible? How do we know the New Testament hasn't been changed over all these years? How do we know it's what was originally written? You familiar with the telephone game? You know, you say one thing and you share it to somebody else, and then you share it to somebody else, and by the time it gets to the end, it's saying something completely different. That is not the Bible. A lot of people like to argue that, but that argument does not stand when it comes to the Scriptures. So how do we know? How can we possibly know what the original documents said? Now, if you're on, I think you should be around page 13 right now, possibly. What we're going to do is we're going to take a moment. I want to go through a little bit of comparative study on ancient documents. Now, you may want to take your pen and write something. There's a science called textual criticism. Textual, T-E-X-T-U-A-L, criticism. Okay, that's not criticizing the way people write texts. Okay, this is a literary science that is there to be able to determine whether an ancient handwriting is legitimate or not. Okay, now within textual criticism is a science called a bibliographical test. Okay, so within textual criticism, there is a test called the bibliographical test. Now, this deals with three tests on an ancient manuscript to determine its validity. Okay, one is the quantity of manuscripts. Okay, how many existing do we have? Now, these are manuscripts. The original autograph is, all of those have since just turned to dust. Okay, so how many copies do we have? The second is the quality of manuscripts, not what kind of shape they're in. It's, are they consistent? Does Codex 1 say the same thing as Codex 200 or Papyri 322 the same thing as Papyri 877? Right? Are they saying the same thing, or is there contradiction? All right. So the number of manuscripts, the quality of manuscripts, and then the time span. What is the span of time we have from the first manuscript we have from the time in which it was written? All right? Make sense? So this is the bibliographical test. Quantity, consistency, and time span. These are the three things. So let's just take a little bit, because history speaks loudly about the Bible. We're going to look at that. So let's just look right now at Herodotus, who was a Greek historian. He wrote of the Greco-Persian Wars. He wrote from 488 to 428 BC, or so before Christ. The earliest copy we have of his writings are 900 AD. That's a 1,300-year time lapse between when he wrote and when we see the first copies, right? And we have about 117 manuscripts. Let's look here at Thucydides, another Greek historian, wrote about the Peloponnesian Wars. It's about the same time he wrote. Earliest copy, 900, about the same gap between when he wrote and the copies that we have are about 104 copies, all right? Livy, okay, Roman historian, History of Rome, 59 B.C. to A.D. 17. So here's a time lapse. He wrote his earliest copy, we have the 400. So we've got a time lapse of only about 400 years. We've got about 170 copies of those. All right, you see, this is how it works. How many copies? Are they consistent? What's the time span? This is not a faith thing. This is a scientific study of ancient texts. Now, let's look at Homer. Not that Homer. Okay, this Homer. All right. Greek poet, wrote the Iliad. You remember we had to read that stuff? I remember reading that stuff. The Trojan War, written 800 B.C. Earliest copy, 400 B.C. Time lapse, 400 years. Existing manuscripts, 1757. They just found a bevy of copies of this. I mean, this is like the mother load of extant manuscripts. So there are no ancient writings with more copies than Homer's Iliad until you get to the New Testament. New Testament, testimony of Christ, the history of the church, written from 40 to 100. The earliest manuscripts we have, partial around AD 130. We have the four Gospels contained at 140 AD. Okay? We have full manuscripts at 350, right? Time lapse about 90 plus years, 90 to 300 years. The number of copies that we have, almost 24,000. Now, the closest to this is Homer's Iliad. There's not an ancient document with as many manuscripts as the New Testament. Now, here's interesting. So we talked about, so what if there's so many of them? What do we want to know? What's the quality? Are all these papyri and codices saying the same thing? 99.5% consistency. And none of those inconsistencies within that 0.5% have anything to do with teachings. They're grammatical. They're sentence structure. They're things such as this. Again, now, does this mean that the Bible is the Word of God? No. But if we're going to look at science and want to use our minds and come to a conclusion as a judge would charge us in a court of law beyond a reasonable doubt, we have to look at this and the evidence that is given to us. All right? So it's kind of interesting. So it's interesting that with the New Testament, that many, when the New Testament was written, were still alive when these documents are beginning to be circulated. F.F. Bruce, who was the professor of New Testament criticism at Manchester University, he wrote a book called The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? This is what Dr. Bruce says. He says, it was not friendly witnesses that the early preachers had to reckon with. There were others less well-disposed who were also conversant with the facts of the ministry and the death of Jesus. The disciples could not afford to risk inaccuracies, not to speak willful manipulation of the facts, which would at once be exposed by those who would be only too glad to do so. On the contrary, one of the strong points in the original apostolic preaching is the confident appeal to the knowledge of the hearers. They not only said, we are witnesses of these things, but also as you yourselves know. You witness them yourselves. Had the tendency been to depart from the facts and in any material respect, the possible pressure of hostile witnesses in the audience would have served as a further corrective. In other words, to debunk this fable that's being made up. But that never did happen. So if you turn to just page 14 in your manual, I'm not going to go through these, but what the Bible tells us is this, that Jesus had a human body. I would encourage you to look at these scriptures when you have some time during the week, that he got tired. The Bible says he got hungry. He had human emotions. He was angry. He was He was sad. He loved. He had human experiences. He was tempted. He learned. He worked. He obeyed. But here's the real question. Was he more than just a good teacher? Was he more than just a prophet, perhaps? Was he more than just a good man? Because that's what you'll get from most folks who haven't really thought about this, like me. But what did Jesus claim about himself? All right, let's look at what his claims were on page 15. Now, I want us to look at this verse right here in the Gospel of John. So in the New Testament, you have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, these four Gospels, which are the testimony of the life and death and resurrection of Jesus. Okay, so this is what Jesus claims. Now, again, not asking you to believe that this is what he's saying is the truth about himself, but this is what he said. He said, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall not hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst." Now, he is not talking about being a grocery store here. He is talking about what we talked about last week when Shia LaBeouf wrote, "Hey, man, if there's this God-sized hole inside of me, if I just knew how to fill it, I would and I'd be on my way." What Jesus says is, "I'm the one that feeds you with a bread that fills your soul, your mind, your will, your emotions." Remember, we talked about last week that every one of us, you know, the three or four philosophical questions there are is, where did I come from? Why am I, origin, why am I here, purpose, who am I, identity, where am I going, destiny. Okay, Jesus says, "I'm the bread of life, and if you come," look what he says here. He says, "I am," he's putting all these things on himself, "I am the bread of life." He doesn't say, "My teaching is the bread of life." He says, "He is the bread of life, and if you come to me, you're not going to hunger. If you believe in me, you'll never thirst." He's not talking about physical thirst. He's talking about a sense of purpose and identity and peace that only he can give. That's his claim. Right? What's he saying here? He's saying he comes to fill our empty souls. That's his claim. Let's look at another one. In the Gospel of John, again, the 8th chapter, the 12th verse, he says, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life." Okay, he's saying here that he gives direction and purpose. He says, "You're in darkness. I'm the light. I will show you." Remember, if you were here last week, if you weren't here last week, I want to encourage you to watch the session from last week, which you can get on our YouTube channel. What he's saying is he is the light. He shows the way. You don't know where you're going if you're in the dark. You have no idea what you're going to fall over, stumble over, fall into. But he says he's the light of the world. If you follow me, you're not going to walk in darkness, but you'll have the light of life. He'll give direction, purpose, show us where to go. That's what he claims. That's the claim that he makes. In the Gospel of Matthew, this is what Jesus says, "Come to me." Again, he's pointing people to himself. You who are weary, heavy burdened, I will give you rest. Take my yoke, that yoke there he's talking about is the yoke of an oxen. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am gentle and humble of heart, and you will find rest for your souls. That's quite a statement that he's making here. You may not believe it, but it's a statement. Now, you know what he said. It's what he said. You come to me, if you're burdened, if you're weary, I will give you rest. I will take the yoke that you are carrying, the disease that you're carrying. I'll give you peace in the midst of the disease that you're carrying, the uncertainty, the circumstances that you have in life. He's claiming that he will carry those with you. And he's humble and gentle, and you will find rest in him for your souls. What's he saying here? He's saying he'll give peace. He'll give a sense of belonging. You will never be alone. I mean, one of the greatest things humans are dealing with right now, and I think it's one of the harshest issues, is loneliness. We've never been surrounded by more ways to communicate, and The issue of loneliness is huge. Suicide rates through the roof in young people. Second highest cause of death in young people. Suicides. Jesus said, I come to give you rest. Come if you'll come to me. He may be full of it, but this is the claim he makes. And then finally, we'll look at this one. John 11, 25, 26. He says, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me shall live, even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. And then he asks Mary, to whom he was having this conversation with, do you believe this? Big question right here. Do you believe this? And next week, we're going to talk a lot about, in the following week, what does this word believe actually mean? And so he is saying he's the resurrection and life. What do you say? He who believes in me shall live, even if he dies. He must be talking about life on the other side of our last heartbeat. Life will continue even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. He's talking here about a life that is beyond physical life. What's he saying? What is he saying here? What's his point? His point is that he says, if you believe in me, you are eternally secure. You are eternally secure in the dash. And he says, on the other side of your last heartbeat, you will be with me forever. That's the claim. Not asking you to believe it, but now you know what he said. It's a statement that he makes about himself. He makes that about himself. It's interesting because Jesus' teaching is centered on himself. Now, it's not whether other religious faiths are true or not, but this is something that is absolutely true. If you can remove Muhammad or Buddha or Krishna or Zoroaster or Confucius or any other religious leader from their teaching, and their teaching remains intact. If you remove Jesus Christ from what we call Christianity, you don't have Christianity. Because everything he said, all the claims he allegedly made, are based on himself, more so than his teaching. And so we see here, and as we continue in our matter, that he made indirect claims and direct claims to being God. In Mark chapter 2, I'm not going to go into this in great detail, he heals someone and forgives their sins, which got the Jews really upset, the Jewish leaders really upset, for good reason, because only God can forgive sin. And on several occasions, they went to stone Jesus because he made those comments, and they believed him to be God, and that was to them blasphemy. Here's a direct claim that he makes. This is in John chapter 10. You may want to write this because I don't know if this one is in your notes. But in John chapter 10, verse 27 through 33, here's what Jesus says. He says, my sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. Now look at this claim. I give them eternal life, and they will never perish. This sounded similar to John chapter 11. And no one will snatch them out of my hand. My Father has given them to me. My Father who has given them to me is greater than all. And no one is able to snatch them out of my hand. And no one is able to snatch them, I'm sorry, out of the Father's hand. I and the Father are one. Who? Big statement. What happens? The Jews picked up stones again to stone him. Jesus answered them, I have shown you many good works from the Father. For which of them are you going to stone me? The Jews answered him, it is not for a good work that we are going to stone you, but for blasphemy, because you, being a man, make yourself God. They picked up the stones again to stone him. They recognized his good works, but they were unwilling for those good works to be the evidence that would move them toward belief. I was taught this little statement once, which is so true because it was true of me for so many years, and it still can be. But it says this: a man or a woman convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. There is this, if God is, if Jesus is, and I am, it's going to require a humble, open heart, inquisitive heart, if I'm going to be open to receive any of the possibility of this being true. That's what had to happen. I had to go from cocksure ignorance to maybe I'm wrong. Maybe all my life I thought I knew who Jesus was, and I just kicked that thing down the can or didn't want anything to do with it. This is nonsense. Maybe not. Maybe there's something to this. Maybe this evidence that I'm looking at is something that possibly I want to consider in ways in which I haven't considered before. Jesus made some claims that we should probably take a look at, right? If he claimed to be God, he either wasn't or he was, right? I mean, that seems, I mean, we're doing decision tree analysis here we're doing. If he claimed to be God, he either wasn't or he was. Now, if he wasn't, he either knew it or he didn't know it. Well, if he knew it and it was wrong, then he's a liar. Not only was a liar, he was a hypocrite because he says, I'm the truth. He would say, truly, truly, I say to you, blah, blah, blah. Not only was he a hypocrite, he was a demon because he's saying, I'm the way to God. I'm the way for you to have eternal life. I'm the way for you to have forgiveness and eternal peace in the dash and in the line. That's what I am. He's a demon. He's leading us down the wrong road. He says this is the right road, but in fact, it's the wrong road. He knew it, and he deliberately lied. But not only that, he's a stinking fool because he gets crucified knowing that what he's saying is a lie. Okay, maybe. But maybe, you know, maybe he thought he was God, but he was wrong. He was just a little light in the head. Okay? And he's a lunatic. He's a nut. Okay? And he was sincerely deluded. But there is not a... When you look at the most antagonistic philosophers and historians toward the Christian faith, or against the Christian faith, I should say, not one of them believes for a moment that he was deluded, that there was no way he could have stood up against the type of people in such pressure and hold it together the way he did. C.S. Lewis, we talked a little bit about him last week, I think. C.S. Lewis was an atheist. He was a professor of ancient English literature at Cambridge and Oxford University. He became a devoted follower of Christ for the Chronicles of Narnia and did broadcast during World War II over the British Broadcasting Network to encourage the troops during World War II. In his book, Mere Christianity, he wrote this about this thought of Jesus being a liar or a lunatic. He said, a man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with the man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. I guess that would make him a deviled egg. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. And he goes on to say this: you can shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. Wow, that's quite a statement. So, if it was false, he knew it, he didn't know it, he was a liar or a lunatic, but if true, if his claims are true, he is, in fact, Lord. And I and you are left with a decision to either reject that claim or accept that claim. To recognize maybe that there is this God-sized hole inside of me that I'm starting to recognize. And nothing so far, no accomplishments, no degrees, no certifications, no accomplishments, no amount of money, no nothing has actually filled that. Maybe it goes like this, and it goes like this, but not truly filled completely. So, what evidence supports what Jesus allegedly claimed? Well, you can see this, I think on page 17, his teaching, his miracles, his character, Hebrew prophecies, hundreds of Hebrew prophecies fulfilled from the Old Testament or the Hebrew Scriptures. Yes, these are pieces of evidence, but Christianity rises and falls on one thing. It rises and falls based on one thing. Did Jesus come out of the tomb alive on that first Easter morning? If not, if he did not, Christianity is a farce. It is not to be believed. It is dangerous. It is stupid to believe this. The Apostle Paul, who was known as Saul, who was a great persecutor of the church, we learn about Saul in the fifth book of the New Testament called the Book of the Acts of the Apostles. He was a former persecutor. He came to believe that Jesus Christ, in fact, is the Messiah of the world. And he believed in him and became, and he wrote 13 of the 27 books of the New Testament. In his book to the Corinthians, his letter to the church at Corinth in Greece, he wrote this in the 15th chapter. He wrote this. He says, "And if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. More than that, we are then found to be false witnesses about God, for we have testified about God that he raised Christ from the dead. If Christ has not been raised from the dead, our faith is futile. You're still in your sins. If only in this life we have hope in Christ, we are to be pitied more than all men. If there is no resurrection from the dead, then not even Christ has been raised." That's how central to the Christian faith resurrection is. If he is not raised from the dead, so what? Just a nice little star that comes on the scene for a little bit and needs to go away. It's interesting. Many have tried to explain away Christ's resurrection. What most all will agree is this, though. On that Easter morning, that body was not there. You may be familiar with the story that when Christ was sealed in the tomb, that Rome was asked to put guards around the tomb because they were afraid that they would come, the followers of Jesus would come and steal the body. And there are several arguments that have come up through the years, and I'm going to give you every one of those arguments. That the women went to the wrong tomb. It was early in the morning. It was dark. It was daylight savings time, and which I can't stand. Well, if they went to the wrong tomb, when they're jumping up and down saying he's not there, well, you just point them to the right tomb. This is not difficult. I went to LSU. So I can figure that out. All right. That the disciples stole his body. Maybe the disciples stole his body. That makes sense, doesn't it? They who had run from Jesus right when he was betrayed are now going to take over this Roman guard that if anybody gets out of that tomb, they're dead. They're killed if their prisoner gets away. The dead prisoner gets away. And so did the disciples steal the body? Well, Think about this for a moment. What if they did overcome the Roman soldiers, move the stone, take the body, hide the body, and then declare Jesus is raised from the dead? They were going to write a book and go on a book tour and make a lot of money. That's what they're going to do. But I can understand dying for a lie if you believe it's true. I do not understand, and I cannot believe they died for a lie, every one of them, but John, knowing that in fact it was a lie. That's tough. That's a tough one to swallow. Maybe the Jewish officials stole the body. That makes sense. Hey, let's move the body, so if they come to take the body, we'll have moved the body and they won't be able to steal the body. Okay, but when everybody starts seeing the empty tomb and starts jumping up and down that he's raised from the dead, what are the Jews going to do? What do you think they're going to do? They're going to show you the body. Well, maybe he didn't die. Ah, that's it. Maybe he didn't die. Maybe he just swooned. Well, can I tell you, nobody survives Roman crucifixion. Before you even get to the cross, you have been whipped to a pulp. Tonight, I think we've got for you, and if you'd like this, there is the American Medical Association. I don't know how much time we're going to have to go through this, but the American Medical Association had an article that was printed in the AMA Journal on the physical death of Jesus Christ, and it goes through what took place at crucifixion. Nobody survives crucifixion. You don't want to survive crucifixion. Before he even gets up on the cross, they would put whips to the back of the person that's going to the cross. These whips were short in length, but they were tied onto them were bone and metal of some sort. And when they would take the whip and whip the back of the person they were crucifying, they would take the whip and then they would drag it down so it just cuts right through the flesh, and over and over and over again, and Jesus' back is probably bleeding profusely. So already the body is going into shock with the loss of blood. They put the crown of thorns, you've seen the size of the thorns, and on its head, and blood is pouring out of his head. When they crucify, they don't run the nail through the hand. They run the nail through the wrist, because if you run the nail through the hand, the nail is going to just rip right through and go out. They put it in the wrist, and it typically hits the ulnar nerve, which would start this type of thing happening. And then you place the nails through his feet, and then just to make sure when the spear went through his side, out came both water and blood, showing he was already gone. And so there's no... But imagine if he did swoon. Okay, he's lost all this blood. He's been crucified. He's going to move this 2,000-3,000-pound stone out of the way. He's going to scare the guards. And then he's going to walk to his disciples with his pierced feet and blood still coming out of him, because he's not dead. And he's going to appear to his disciples as the resurrected Christ. I don't think so. So what happened? It's interesting, because there's so many people that have been challenged with this. You're going to get a book from us either next week or the week after. By an author called Lee Strobel. He wrote the book, The Case for Christ, and he's written this little book called The Case for Easter. Lee Strobel was the chief legal editor of the Chicago Tribune. He was a total atheist. His wife came to believe that the claims of Christ were true. It made him crazy. One of his co-workers at the Chicago Tribune said, "You're a journalist. You're an investigative journalist. Why don't you go find out for yourself?" He said, "Well, that's not a bad idea." So he did. And guess what happened? He wrote a book called The Case for Christ. He became a follower of Christ and has written multiple books and has spoken to millions of people all over the world. The same thing is true with another book that, if you've not received this yet, we want to give you as a gift tonight, called More Than a Carpenter, by a guy named Josh McDowell. Josh McDowell, another atheist, was challenged to, okay, you don't believe this? Prove it. And he was challenged. And he has written, this is the cliff notes of the cliff notes of everything Josh McDowell has written, spoken all over the world to millions and millions of people. Frank Morrison was a British journalist, and he wrote this book. He was going to write a book against against Christianity. Look at that. You see that? You can't see that? Okay. I can't either, actually. But here's chapter one of his book, The Book That Refused to be Written. He tried with everything that was in him to debunk Christianity and the cross, and he couldn't do it. So many have wrestled with the question, who is Jesus? And I would argue that that question that has echoed through the canyons of time ends up in this room right here tonight on March 17th. The question of the resurrection. Who is he? What does that mean to me? You know, Jesus, while he was still alive, asked that question to his disciples, and we have it recorded in the 16th chapter of Matthew. This is what it says. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say the Son of Man is? That was a term that Jesus would use for himself. They replied, some say John the Baptist. Others say Elijah. And still others, Jeremiah or one of the prophets. But what about you? Who do you say that I am? I think that's a question for each of us to think about tonight. Not what my priest says, or my pastor says, or my wife or my grandmother says he is. Who do you say he is? Not who do you box check on a Sunday say that he is. Not who are you giving lip service to say that he is. But who with full-throated, faith-filled conviction says, believes, lives that I am? That's a question I had to ask myself. To get from cocksure ignorance to begin to wonder and think of who he is. This question popped into my head one day, a question maybe we can consider tonight. What if who I say Jesus is to me determines who Jesus says I am to him? Think about that. What if who I say Jesus is to me determines who Jesus says I am to him? And this leads us into week three. Next week, the topic, why did Jesus die? Another cocksure, ignorant thought in my mind. Of course I know that. I'm an American, for heaven's sake. Who doesn't know that? But here lies the question, what are the ramifications for you and me if he did come out of that tomb on that first Easter morning, was in fact resurrected? What does the person of Jesus Christ, his life, actually have to do with me and the way I live my life or the purpose and the meaning that I have in life? Have you possibly not critically examined who Jesus is? Closely enough, or maybe not at all, just haven't seen the need. And we're going to address all this next week. And I just want to ask you a favor. Just come one more week, all right? Give us one more week to overfeed you. But I guarantee you, you're going to hear some things next week. I feel like weeks one and two are just kind of a warm-up to what's going to happen in week three and week four. Particularly. Now look, it's not too late to invite a friend. If you want to invite someone to come, we're going to make room. We can do that. We want to do that. If you're watching live stream, we can get manuals to you. We can get you information that you'd like on online as well. If you'd like to get a copy of the AMA article on the physical death of Jesus and we don't have it for you, if you'd like a digital copy, you can just email me at frank@lakeviewchristiancenter.com, and we'll do that. All right, let's take a quick break. We got coffee. We got soft serve. That's why you're still coming back. I know that. We appreciate you being here. Thank you so much for your time. Let's get back to our tables and hope to see you next week.